Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Thank you for not wearing the same outfit as me today. I appreciate that.
We should do a consult beforehand. I'm usually in flannel, so I can understand you were thinking of going with stripes last week wouldn't have been a problem, but I threw you a curveball, and for that, I'm sorry. I hope the paparazzi did not skewer you too badly.
Well, don't let it happen again. It was distracting, and I think it's unacceptable behavior, frankly.
I woke up this morning to your Twitter feed thinking, I know how much you prize bipartisan cooperation and a functional democracy, but you were displeased at the outlines of this budget deal struck by Paul Ryan and Patty Murray.
That's right, Bill. Look, I just think that the sequester is not perfect, but it was the only thing that actually has cut spending, it's brought deficits down. And I'm of the opinion, look, let's just, you know, pass a continuing resolution, keep sequester level spending where it is. I don't get why Republicans would go out of their way to try to tweak it. It wasn't perfect, but I think it's probably as good as it gets. And there's a little bit of a schism on the right over this right now. And this, you know, I was against the shutdown strategy. And in this instance, I'm, I guess, siding with the Tea Party grassroots folks. But I'm not alone. You know, Tom Coburn this morning on Morning Joe, who was with, you know, against the fund strategy, is also saying that this is a bad, you know, bad deal.
And so you thought, you think it would have made sense, you know, after being burned so badly with the shutdown tactic in October, you think it would have been a better strategy for Republicans to walk away from this, put maintaining sequester as is on the floor, and if Democrats balk, government shuts down, try to push that blame off of the Democrats. You think that is better than what's essentially a pretty minor tweaking? It's not repealing the sequester. It's an adjustment. It's not even net additional spending.
Well, if you believe the supposed future spending cuts, but look, no, I think that there's a huge difference between what happened a couple months ago and what should have happened now. I mean, it's audacious and quixotic to try to defund Obamacare, and it was destined to fail. In this instance, you would just merely be advocating maintaining the status quo. It's a much more defensible position, and if Democrats, if they want to shut down the government over maintaining sequester-level spending, then that would be on them.
Well, I think what Republicans were thinking, at least Republican leaders are thinking, is, number one, you know, maybe we could have tried to pull that in September, but now our leverage is totally shot after having gone to the shutdown well, you know, once too often. So we really just can't.
Well, that's just another example of why the defund strategy was such a bad idea. And I think it also cost Republicans the Virginia gubernatorial election. And maybe it could end up hurting them now in the effort to keep spending low. Another unintended consequence.
All right, so I think there's that aspect that if its reputation of just sort of constantly toying with keeping government open, that just makes them look like unserious about governing. Second, you know, you talk about status quo being sort of easier to defend than repealing Obamacare, but, you know, Obamacare is more polarizing than sequester. Everybody hates sequester. Sequester polls at 18% in the most recent National Journal poll. So that's pretty hard. That's not firm ground to stand on. And so I think they're very reluctant to go to the mat for something that's sort of universally reviled, no matter whether you want to spend more or spend less. Almost everybody thinks that sequester is the wrong way to go about it. And then number three, in the second wave of sequester that kicks in January, if this deal did not pass, it's the military that gets kicked in the teeth the hardest. And so you get a lot of Republicans on the merits say, we just don't want to see the military gets squeezed anymore than it has to. So I think you had a lot of political and policy reasons why Ryan and Boehner, you know, were eager to defuse this. And then on the Democratic side, I know some of my Democratic friends feel that, you know, hey, we had the upper hand here. We should have drove a much harder bargain. We should have made sure that, you know, unemployment insurance got put into this deal. We should have got higher spending levels out of this. There's no need to extend this Medicare cut an extra 2 years on the back end of the deal. There's no need to have to cut into new pensions for new federal workers or for military retirees. But the Democrats had an interest in just diffusing the tension and not having the entire congressional session all the way into 2015 be nonstop budget battle. Even that might have made Republicans look bad. It might have made some political sense for November, but there is this window of opportunity to get immigration done by the spring. And if you're constantly in gridlock over the budget, you don't have the room and the time to cut that final deal. Right. I mean, they lost a lot of time in the fall already. So I think they really much want to clear the deck and give this one last shot.
Well, that's an argument for why Republicans might have been able to get away with driving not even a hard bargain, just maintaining the status quo. Democrats don't want to get bogged down in this fight again here at the end of the year. They want to move on to legislative stuff, you know, proactively, possibly immigration reform. And so I just, you know, I think that Republicans may be grasping defeat from the jaws of victory here. You mentioned that sequester is unpopular. I think any spending is unpopular, but it's easier to like maintain a current policy than to try to like come back later and get spending cuts. It's nearly impossible to ever cut spending. So I would just argue.
I know you're skeptical about the back end cuts here, but even putting that aside, I mean, there's still upfront stuff in the public pension cuts, and there's revenue being gone through user fees
also known as like taxes, tax increases.
I know Grover Norquist accepts user fees when it's actually about, you know, getting something for a particular service. He considers
depends if it's a tax. I assume it's a euphemism or if it's legit, but yeah, good valid point.
Right. So I mean, there is some up. It's not all back end. There is some upfront stuff here, and it's all pretty minor. I mean, I mean, I'm not a sequester fan. I don't think Spinella should be that low. But if that's what I wanted, I just don't see this as being all that surrendery. You know, it's a step back a bit, but there's still a cap here. You're still having net deficit reduction. The fear of having this be sort of like a crack in the dike that's going to explode later. I mean, you still have Republicans dead set against bona fide tax increases, and you still have Democrats, I think, a little softer, but sort of dead set against cutting Social Security and Medicare without the tax increases. And so, as long as those two firewalls are in place, you still have a form of sequester. It's just not maybe as severe as it was a week ago, but it's still there. You're still having a deficit reduction. I wouldn't think, even if you didn't love it, I wouldn't think it would make sense to say, kill the deal and have a shutdown, because it's not exactly the level that you wanted at. You're still largely keeping a lid on growth of government spending.
Well, I think it's just, I mean, it's going to be perceived, it is perceived by, you know, the base as like a non sequitur and sort of like a unilateral surrender. Why this is the only thing that's actually worked. It's not perfect, but it's actually worked to cut spending. Why open the door to raising spending? Nobody believes in these, you know, future cuts. But look, let's just talk practically speaking. I mean, Coburn's against it. Rubio's against it. Eric Erickson's against it. FreedomWorks is against it. Rand Paul's against it. The Club for Growth's against it. Americans for Prosperity's against it. Heritage Action's against it. How does this pass the Republican House? How does it pass?
Well, I mean, most of the things that you've mentioned there are people who used up all the peas in their pea shooter.
Most
in
of them, but people like me, and Tom Coburn were against the defund strategy, and now we find ourselves sort of on the other side. So it leads me to believe that this it's a more broad based coalition against this deal.
Well, I mean, if there were a lot of Coburns out there, you have a headcounting problem. I would be doubtful that a lot of Republicans are afraid of a Heritage Action score today versus in October. I think you have more Republicans saying, if I'm letting Heritage Action dictate my voting record, I am destroying this party. I have to break away from that eventually. And you're getting closer and closer to primary filing deadlines. There's only so many last minute, and we can talk about this a little bit, how many last minute primary challenges you have to worry about, and if they do jump in last minute, are they going to be well funded enough to really give you a run for your money? So the closer you get to the primary filing deadlines, the more liberated I think Republican congresspeople are going to be. And again, I think you have this military piece here where I think some Republicans might be, where they were sort of willing to screw the military in March of last year. Some Democrats thought they would never do it at all, and they were willing to have sequester, take a shave off the Pentagon. This second cut went a lot deeper, and I think is making more Republicans nervous. So I think they're going to be willing to side with the military-industrial complex over Heritage Action right. this time
well,
around.
Well, let me say, it's not – I don't want to be like recalcitrant or whatever. I mean, I would love for a deal that actually cut – long-term entitlement spending in return for rejiggering the sequester, which as we both know, wasn't like a great budgeting, great accomplishment in budgeting.
But you wouldn't go Simpson Bowles. You wouldn't go tax increases for that.
Prefer not to go full Simpson. You never go full Simpson Bowles. But a lot of what was in Simpson Bowles was great. And frankly, as I've been saying for years, Barack Obama should have just embraced it. And it would have been very difficult for Republicans to fight against that.
Well, I mean, he has, in part, he did come out with chain CPI, which is in Simpson Bowles. Basically said, I would do tax increases for chain CPI, and Republicans snubbed it.
Well, I think, we don't get into this again, but tax increases are off the table.
Well, right. That's Simpson Bowles. That's what the deal is in Simpson Bowles.
Well, that's
so. Since it is off the table, you have Ryan Murray instead of Simpson Bowles.
Well, and therein lies the problem. But we'll see what happens. Look, I'm just saying. I think this could be a bigger fight than anyone knows. Maybe I'm wrong. I've been wrong before. And look, the fact that you think that this could lead to immigration reform. As yet another argument for why the grassroots conservatives may be upset about this. That's not a feature, it's a bug.
Right. Well, I do wonder, I don't think this deal is going to get scotched, but if it got scotched, man, the blowback of Republicans, I think they would suffer. You guys can't govern at all. You have a deal in place. That's not all that controversial, and you still can't stomach it. Would that drive Boehner, so insane? Like, I'm just going to take some immigration and shove it down your throat because you're making it impossible for Republicans to sustain as a governing party. So it might be a lose-lose for the anti-immigration. But it all depends. There might be some people thinking that I'm crazy thinking that that's right around the corner. But I think the fact that you have both Boehner and Obama saying last month that they would accept a series of bills as opposed to a comprehensive bill, and you have Boehner making this hire as his immigration point person, the director of immigration for the Bipartisan Policy Center, former McCain aide who is known to be for a pathway to citizenship, hiring that is a sign of serious intent on Boehner's part. And the fact that Ryan is someone who's also said he's for immigration reform, doing this deal and taking an obstacle away from immigration reform all says to me that that the leadership wants it. They do want
it. Seems like it.
Some people might be
skeptical. Surprised. I thought they'd be much more chastened by the pushback that Rubio and others got from the grassroots. It's funny because the grassroots conservatives and Tea Party folks have been so paranoid about the establishment selling out and pushing these things, whether it's the budget deal or immigration. I always thought they were paranoid, Look, it's not like Bill Frist and Tom DeLay, they've been gone for a long time. And a lot of the concern was over the big government conservatism stuff from a decade ago in some cases, Medicare Part D or whatever. But it turns out that maybe they weren't paranoid. It seems like Boehner and Ryan, and by the way, I wrote a piece about Ryan back in 2010, pointing out that, you know, he was for TARP, he was for the auto bailout, he was for a confiscatory tax on CEO bonuses. I mean, he's thought of as being this great fiscal conservative, and his record's pretty good, except when you look at these really high-profile votes, he's been on the wrong side of a lot of them. So it is interesting that here we go again with that, and will it ever stick to him?
So do you think that for Ryan to do this deal, he is doing it from Ryan's perspective? Is he doing it thinking, if I cut this deal and I prove that Washington can work and I can work the other side, that's going to help me become president, it will help me win a primary, it will help me in the general election? Or is it a sign that I know I'm not going to win a primary, that dream is dead, the Republican base has moved on, so I might as well show Washington that I can make Washington work and bolster my chance to become speaker on when the day comes where Boehner might step down, which for all we know could be
I just assume that Ryan thinks this is the right thing to do on its merits. Having said that, I've never thought he really wanted to be president. I've always thought that he wants to be Speaker of the House, and he loves the budgets and wonky stuff like that. So I don't think he's motivated primarily by trying to run for president. I think that he sees himself as eventually the Speaker of the House, and any political calculus that might be involved here, I think would be aimed in that direction.
Now, we talked a little bit about primary challenges before. We have a last-minute primary challenge in the Texas Senate primary. Senator John Cornyn, he's in the Senate Republican leadership. He has the second most conservative voting record in the House, yet he's still too establishment for some. And Congressman Steve Stockman, probably one of the brashest, most right-wing, straight-up birther congresspeople that we have, jumping in late. The actual primary is only, I think, weeks away, or 2-3 months, and that I think this makes for 7 primary challenges of Senate Republican incumbents versus only one on the Democratic side, and that is a Democrat that was appointed in a winner election. So you can understand that person might be more ripe for a challenge. I don't even think that race is considered an ideological battle, but everything on the Republican side is sort of right versus far right. Is this causing any consternation in conservative circles where you stand?
I don't think so, because I don't think anybody thinks that Stockman can beat John Cornyn. There's just not enough time. You have to have kind of a perfect storm to pull this off. You have to have, an incumbent who's asleep at the wheel, who's done something egregious. You have to have a primary opponent that can get near unanimity in terms of conservative support. And I think you need enough time to catch fire. You know, a lot of times these candidates languish for a while, kind of in obscurity, and then something happens over time, they catch fire. And I think in that regard, Stockman's 0-3. I mean, Cornyn is, he's not a perfect conservative, but the Club for Growth said they were going to stay out because he has a pretty darn good fiscal conservative voting record.
I mean, where's the hesitation? I mean, is there something that, from a liberal perspective, we've never heard of Cornyn seen as ever going rogue and doing anything that was breaking from party line? What is there some sort of soft underbelly there that made Club for Growth pause that Stockman could exploit and make a late sprint in this snatching this away from Cornyn?
Well, as I mentioned, the clubs decided to stay out of this because they're saying that Cornyn has a pretty good record. But other conservatives...
But they didn't endorse right away. They waited until this challenge came about, right? At some point, they seem to be sitting on their hands.
Well, you know, there may be no need to support Cornyn if he doesn't have a viable opponent. Why would you do it? Why would you weigh in at all? Mm-hmm. But... Mm-hmm. putting that aside, I would say that Cornyn, you know, I don't know that there's any like egregious vote or picture of him hugging Barack Obama or something like that that will hurt him. He is sort of guilty of being in the leadership. I think he's the number two Republican in the Senate. So being establishment doesn't help. You could always imply that all those backroom deals, Mitch McConnell cuts, John Cornyn tacitly signs off on, and then he'll get a pass to vote differently. There's all that cloak and dagger stuff. And Cornyn's also guilty of being like an old white guy. I mean, it's not the best thing to be, even in the Republican Party. And so I just, it's just boring establishment. He's, you know, temperamentally moderate, even if he has a fairly conservative voting record. He's not out there fighting and leading. And so that's just the typical baggage. I think he weathers the storm just like Orrin Hatch, also an old white guy. Although, let me say, my tip for the old white guys is to wear the hipster glasses. Orrin Hatch sometimes wears them. It makes them more interesting. I have some. I'm going to just let me don them, if that's the correct word for putting on glasses. This is what you need right here. Rick Perry is looking more intellectual with them. I suggest if you need something. Now, during the Romney era, I almost got a monocle. I thought that might be my hook for, you know, my TV sort of crutch, you know, that a monocle would really represent the Romney era. But, you know, in lieu of that, I would say you got to have some sort of flair. And the glasses are, you know, men, there's only so many things. You got the pocket squares. There's not a lot that men can do. So I would recommend for John Cornyn to get some of those. You want the kind of the Chris Saliza glasses is what you need. It will give you that sort of hipster thing. And Bill, I think you should be wearing them as well. I mean, I think you and I both were, you know, we started this thing 4 or 5 years ago. We may need to turn to them at some point.
I have nerdy glasses that I wear at other times, but I got these baby blues. I can't cover the baby.
Well, that's
up.
The same, you know, problem I have. It's almost a sin to do it, but occasionally you do it. But I think that's the move for the old white, you know, politician is to rock. You know, Orrin Hatch has done it. Rick Perry's done it. I'd like to see it spread. I'd like to see more of it, frankly.
Well, a grander debate than sequester, than business versus Tea Party, than stodgy old white guys versus hipster glasses. A bigger debate kicked up this week, which is Love actually a good movie? Which I saw, there's a big essay in The Atlantic saying it was the least romantic movie of all time, and this... I tell you, you agree with that because then you leapt in and said we should ditch Love Actually as a holiday classic and return to the good old wholesome values of It's a Wonderful Life. And I'm watching this saying I can't believe anyone's treating Love Actually like it is worthy of analytical discussion in the first place. Wasn't it always understood to be a junk food cable filler movie that just passed the time away when your family comes over during the holidays? When did it become a point of
I think
of
I have the answer. I think
it eludes me, but
I actually think I have the answer for you. And I think it's because Netflix is streaming it. Because there was a time when you couldn't get Love Actually. I tried, like, I think maybe even last Christmas, it's thought of as a Christmas movie, a holiday movie. I tried to, it wasn't on Netflix. You couldn't stream it, at least. Maybe you could have had it delivered. I don't do that, so... that was out for me. And you couldn't even buy it on iTunes. But this year, Netflix is streaming it. I suspect that's why you've seen a renewed interest in it. My wife, Erin, and I just rewatched it. I saw it when it first came out at the theaters. However many years ago that was, a decade ago probably, or more. I think it was right after 9/11, maybe. So about a decade ago. I think 9/11 is referenced in the beginning of it. And so I rewatched it a couple of weeks ago, a decade older and more mature and a better, you know, a better sort of critic of movies. And when I got done watching it, I had the same exact, you know, I told my wife all the things that ended up being in this Atlantic piece that got a lot of traction about how it's the least romantic movie ever made.
And the correct answer to that question is Serendipity, by the way. It's
well,
not love, actually.
Similar era, similar, similar shtick. But then I decided to juxtapose it, you know, with It's a Wonderful Life to show, like, how far we've come in the wrong direction. Because It's a Wonderful Life is chock full of moral lessons. And Love Actually, as the Atlantic piece points out, essentially is just about superficial physical attraction. As they point out, one of the most sort of compelling storylines is with a husband who flirts with cheating on his wife. We don't even know how that situation's resolved. It's unclear how that resolves. So they sort of leave that hanging. It's junk food, I think, is a good way of describing it. But I think the fact that it's so popular is sort of, and it doesn't ever arrive at any virtuous. There is no virtue really in the movie. Love, I guess, is always held up as a virtue, but it's the most superficial kind of love. And I think that it's sort of packaged as this feel-good movie that really, when you dig in, all of the values and morals imparted are pretty unsavory.
I just don't think anyone's trying to dig into Love Actually.
But it impacts the culture, Bill, whether anyone else is intellectually trying to derive meaning from it. The films, the movies, the entertainment that we consume as a society says something about us and will eventually filter into our values. And so by juxtaposing it with a movie
it says that we like to kill time with mediocre pablo.
But why is it that Casablanca and It's a Wonderful Life had these heroic and really romantic and uplifting positive messages, and the movies of today, like Love Actually or of a decade ago, don't have those as a rule in general?
I think Love Actually is a movie when it was in theaters did not do very well. It's one of those movies that sustains on cable reviewings. and it's the kind of movie, like, if you're sitting at home on a Sunday and you don't have anything else to do and you kind of flip it around, you land on it, you sit back, you turn your brain off, and you kill a couple hours. I don't think it's really intended to be much more than that. It's a slapdash amalgamation of like 8 sitcom plots, some of which, you point out, don't
and
even
some
resolve.
Some of which don't have any connection to others. I mean, the funniest, star, the aging rock star and his manager is probably the most fun of the like vignettes. And yet, I don't think it ever connects, other than people associated with the other plots listening to the song on the radio. There is no other,
right?
You know,
right? It's a movie done on the cheap. It's a style of movie where you only get big name stars if they're in like 3 scenes, so you don't have to pay them their full. Hugh Grant is the one who has the most screen time for the most part. I mean, it's eight sitcoms mushed into one. So 8 people don't have a lot of individual screening. You don't pay them as much money. You can do it low budget, and you'll make the money on DVD rentals and royalties on cable. You're not going to get it in the theaters right off. That's the model for a movie like that. It's not meant to be a big sweeping classic. I'm befuddled why it's so. Analyze whatever you want, of course, but it seems to be holding it to a standard I don't think it was ever trying to attain.
It's become a cult classic. It does have a lot of big name people in it. I think that the Netflix, you can't underestimate the impact they've had. And look, we need stuff to write about, Bill. And someone saw it and decided, they had the same thought I had. I was like, wow, this is thought of as a good movie, and yet there are all these plot holes and all these problems and a horrible message. Horrible, you know, as ostensibly a feel-good holiday movie. And they needed something to write about, so they wrote it. But I do want to plug this. Because
can I write an essay about Point Break now? Can I write about how it is completely inauthentic to real surf culture? Will I get traffic if I do that?
If you wrote that, Bill, people would love it. They would eat it up, and it would probably be the most viral thing you or I have ever written. And let's be honest about what this is. But look, I want to recommend something else I wrote because it'll make a point better than I can right now. Okay. Extemporaneously. All right. I wrote a piece, and you can find it at the Daily Caller if you Google about why porn is arguably better than for society than rom-coms. I wrote a searing indictment on rom-coms and how they are hurting our society. And I wrote that, a couple months ago, but check it out because I think it's pretty damn good. I don't think it got the attention it deserved.
Well, people should also check out your recent piece about, what values we should hold dear from It's a Wonderful Life, a movie which I will admit I've actually never seen all the way through. I'm not old.
And then while we're plugging stuff, I know we're almost out of time, but go read Bill's piece on Mandela, which didn't get
which nobody read
because it wasn't about selfies or shaking Raul Castro's hand. It was actually much more. Certainly more substantive than selfies. So go check that out at The Week as well. It's worth your time. All right.
Thank you.
Another award-winning show. Good news, people. Not only can you follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show, but we now, after years of fighting with Facebook, we now have DMZ Show also that you can search. I don't think we have the URL yet, but you can search for it, DMZ Show. We finally changed it from The Weekend Blog, which was quite a struggle, but we did it. I've been told we can only make that change once. So this show can never change.
That Silicon Valley bureaucracy.
But Bill, always good talking to you.
You too, sir. And
we'll
talk next week.
See ya.
Take care.